Thus, given enough time and popularity, every movie, every song, and every document will be available to the general public for free. The nature of information does not allow for another outcome. Hence the saying, information wants to be free. Although trying to create something that can't exist, information that can't be copied, is paradoxical in itself, this isn't what I mean by the DRM paradox. What I mean is something more hilarious. It is again psychological, not technical in nature. The paradox is this. Content will only stay behind a paywall if it is shitty. If it's good, someone will set it free. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are diving into another piece by Gigi on streaming sats, on the value for value model being kind of pioneered by the podfather himself, by Adam Curry, and podcasting 2.0. This article is titled "The Freedom of Value." This is a really great piece, and I love. There's so many good little dynamics about the internet itself, how we relate to information, and how much that has changed without us quite recognizing just how much it has changed. So there's a lot to unpack, and this is just such a good article. Now I want to say too, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, you don't realize that this is the end of my day. That I've gotten to where I do my intros at the end of all of this. So as soon as I say, and it's titled, I'm actually done. I'm done for the day. I'm about to pack up and I'm going to export and I'm going to publish and do all that stuff. So I'm finally letting all the weight off. And, you know, I just kind of felt like I wanted to share that. Of course, I'll probably record a little bit more before I go to bed tonight. So we'll see. But let's get into this piece. Let's stop wasting time. Let's thank our sponsors real quick. We've got the Swan Bitcoin, the place for Bitcoiners to buy Bitcoin. It is a no-brainer. Automatically stack, automatically send to your keys. And then the BitBox, that's where you keep your keys. That's where you're gonna keep that shit safe on your digital vault for your digital keys, for your digital money and your digital life. And then you're going to come hang out at Bitcoin 2022 because, man, it's going to be epic and you're going to miss out. But you get 10% off with code GuySwan. So don't forget that. 10% discounts are good discounts. Check it all out. GuySwan.com and links in the show notes. Okay. With that, it is time to get into today's piece. And it's titled, The Freedom of Value. By Dergigi. How value for value fixes the monetization of information. The internet has a problem. Few people know that this problem exists, but hey, that's the nature of serious, non-obvious problems. They are invisible until they aren't. The problem with the internet is that information wants to be free. And if something wants to be free, as in freedom, given enough time, it will also be free, as in beer. Let me explain. Poisoning the air. We consume untold amounts of data every day. Every second of every minute, bits and bytes are streaming through the series of tubes that we all know and love. The internet. We take it for granted, and most of us take the current monetization model, as well as all the ills that come along with it, for granted as well. We seldom stop and think about the strange world of bits and bytes, how wonderful it all is, but also how alien. How it already has transformed our lives, and how it will continue to transform our future. Where do the zeros and ones come from? What makes it all work? And most importantly, who is paying for it? The bits and bytes that are zipping through our fiber optic cables are as invisible as the air we breathe. That's not a terrible metaphor, now that I think of it. As long as we have no trouble breathing, we don't need to stop and inspect every single molecule we inhale. Similarly, as long as we don't have too much trouble creating and consuming digital content, we don't need to stop and inspect all the various parts that make our attention economy work. Attention economy. What a fitting description. As we should all know by now, the stuff we consume isn't free. We are paying dearly for it, with our attention, among other things. Paying attention. In the high-velocity world of today, to maximize profits, you have to maximize attention. But it is a peculiar, shallow kind of attention. It is not the focused kind of attention that deep thought and meaningful conversations would require. I believe that this is, at least in part, why many things are so broken. Why our societal discourse is so fragmented. Our politics so polarized. We so paralyzed. And our analysis often as shallow as our desires. The attention economy has us neatly segregated into echo chambers of personal truths. Ironically, the only truth worth pursuing in the attention economy is how to keep the maximum amount of people maximally outraged for the maximum amount of time, all while keeping participants unaware that they are trapped in an algorithmic prison of their own choosing. You are the product. The idiom, if something is free, you are the product, can't be repeated often enough. For one reason or another, we expect most things to be free online. Of course, there's no such thing as a free lunch. In the case of online services, your data is harvested and sold to the highest bidder, which is usually an advertisement or government agency, or both. Not only do all big data companies spy on you, but they will also use a multitude of dark patterns and unethical practices to squeeze out every last drop of data from your interactions. Whether it is the Facebook Pixel, Google Analytics, or something else, doesn't matter. You are being tracked, surveilled, and cataloged. What you see, for how long, at what times, how frequently, and what you'll see next is carefully orchestrated by a profit-maximizing algorithm. Profit for the platform, not for you. Of course, the idea is usually that everyone profits, users, creators, advertisers, and the platforms alike. However, the evolutionary environment that is set up by said incentive structures will often select for shallow, attention-grabbing, and sensationalist snippets. As of this writing, block 716,025, the epitome of such an environment is TikTok, a video-based dopamine machine that will show you the motion picture equivalent of heroin mixed with crack cocaine. Hard drugs for the mind, custom tailored to your particular likings. A truly cursed app. Unfortunately, most platforms of this nature are just different in degree, not in kind. A loud opinion. It isn't so bad, we say to ourselves. Look at all the useful information, we exclaim as we scroll through our feeds, inadvertently feeding the machine that is feeding us dopamine hits in return. But make no mistake, the companies in charge are not in the business of feeding us useful or truthful information. They are in the business of tricking us into feeding the machine. How could it be otherwise? You are what you track, and you become what you optimize for. From the platform's perspective, this is clicks, not quality. At first, maximizing clicks and watch time might be an innocuous thing. After all, you have to make money to survive. It's just one ad. How bad can it get? Unfortunately, the problems that come with it all are invisible at first. Just like cancer is invisible to the smoker who just smoked his first cigarette, and liver cirrhosis is invisible to the drinker who just had his first drink. Deplatforming, censorship, polarization, and manipulation of public opinion are invisible to the prosumer who just saw his first ad in a walled garden ecosystem. We can probably agree that we are past the first inning when it comes to these issues. Censorship is the norm. Deplatforming is cheered on. Polarization is at an all-time high, and public opinion is manipulated manually and algorithmically like never before. The consensus is that you are too stupid to know what is good for you, and your public opinion is too outrageous to be voiced publicly. Even worse, it shouldn't be your opinion in the first place. Here is why you're wrong. Here is a source pointing to an allowed opinion. Here are some experts that agree with us. Our smart and helpful algorithms did all the thinking for you, and they are never wrong. Neither are the experts. This is the world we are already living in. You're not allowed to speak freely. You are not allowed to think freely. You are not allowed to express yourself freely. Your picture is offensive. Thus, it has to be removed. Your meme is too close to the truth or too criminally funny. Thus, we have to put you in Twitter jail for a week or two. You are saying something that we don't agree with. Thus, we have to ban you for life. Even if you are a sitting president, mind you. You have said the wrong word in a video or played a copyrighted song in the background. Thus, we have to take away your income. You have posted a picture of yourself without a mask. Thus, we'll have to ban you and report you to the authorities. The fact that the sentence above is not purely in the realm of dystopian science fiction anymore should have everyone worried. Removed from cyberspace for wanting to breathe free. Strange times. Evolutionary pressure. How did it come to this? If I were forced to give a short answer, I would give the following. We moved from protocols to platforms, and platforms are only as good as their incentives. The incentive structure of the platforms we inhabit is the evolutionary environment that dictates survival. Everything that wants to survive has to align with it. Of course, this is true in all areas of business. Pick print magazines, for example. For very human evolutionary reasons, if your magazine doesn't sport a beautiful female face on the front cover, it won't be bought as much as those who do. Thus, it won't be able to replicate itself and consequently will die. Similarly, if your online news outlet does not generate enough ad revenue, it will fail to replicate and die. This is why every magazine has a beautiful female face on the cover. And this is why every ad-based online news outlet devolves into clickbait. Similarly, this is why feed-based recommendation engines devolve into slot machines for your dopamine receptors. The longer you stayed glued to your screen, the more ads you will see, the more revenue will be generated for the platform. This is also why most YouTube channels devolved into 7 to 15 minute snippets with thumbnails that portray the face of someone who just stepped on a piece of Legos. Short enough to convince you to watch it, long enough to make you forget what video you wanted to watch in the first place. Like rats pushing buttons in hyper-personalized Skinner boxes, we are conditioned into addiction cycles to maximize shareholder profits. Maximizing profits. Platforms are companies. And companies are incentivized to maximize shareholder profits. There is nothing wrong with profits, and there is nothing wrong with shareholders. However, I believe that the information revolution we find ourselves in has split the evolutionary landscape into two. Let's call these landscapes broad and narrow. To maximize profits via broad advertisements, controversies and extreme opinions have to be minimized. Thus, just by catering to the lowest common denominator, politics and censorship immediately enter the picture. Conversely, if profits are made via narrow, targeted advertisements, controversies and extreme opinions have to be maximized. Thus, just by showing different pieces of information to different subgroups, polarization and fragmentation are continually increased. These two extremes are two sides of the same coin. It might seem like it is cable TV versus the algorithmic newsfeed, but it actually is two different approaches pursuing the same goal: to keep as many people glued to the screen so they can watch more advertisements. The first is a sedative. The second is a stimulant. Granted, the above characterization might be an exaggeration, but the problem remains. If we aren't paying for something directly, we will be paying for it indirectly, one way or another, always. The point is the following: free speech platforms cannot exist. Only free speech protocols can exist. If someone can control what is being said, someone will control what is being said. If you can monitor, filter, and censor content, you will monitor, filter, and censor content. All platforms will run into this problem, no matter how pristine their intentions. Even if you position yourself as a free speech platform at first, you will be forced to step in and censor in the long run. After all, if you can be squashed by the state for content you host or transmit, you will be squashed by the state for content you host or transmit. Self-censorship. However, long before state censorship will rear its ugly head, the chilling effect of self-censorship will be felt. If others are deplatformed and demonetized for voicing certain opinions, most people will be very careful to voice said opinions. Consciously and subconsciously, we slowly silence ourselves. When it comes to self-censorship, advertisements have a role to play too. After all, you wouldn't bite the hand that feeds you, would you? In the worst case, advertisers and executives will tell you what can be said and what is off-limits. They will tell you what opinions are inside the Overton window and which ones are outside of it. And if they don't, you will make an educated guess and adjust what you say accordingly. A problem and a paradox. Back to the original problem. Why can't we sell information like a regular good? Why does the simplistic approach, putting content behind a paywall, produce such bad results? I believe there are two reasons, which I will call the MTX problem and the DRM paradox. The MTX problem, with MTX being short for mental transaction, refers to the problem of irreducible mental transaction costs inherent to every transaction. Every time you hit a paywall, you have to make a conscious decision. Do I want to pay for that? As Szabo convincingly argues, most of the time, especially if the cost is tiny, the answer will be no. This is not for any technical reason, but for psychological reasons. It turns out that the hassle of figuring out whether this transaction is worth it or not, a process that is happening in your head, is simply too much. If you have to think about a micro purchase, the chance that you will make said purchase diminishes drastically. This is why flat rates and subscriptions are king. You only have to think about them once. For the smallest of microtransactions, this is even true from a strictly economic standpoint. Using an hourly wage of $20, thinking, "Is this worth 20 sats?" for 2 seconds will cost you a little over 1 cent, which is more than the price of the microtransaction in question. It is unfeasible, both psychologically and economically. This, in a nutshell, is the MTX problem. But this isn't the only thing that is plaguing the monetization of digital content. As mentioned above, there is also the DRM paradox. DRM, short for Digital Rights Management, is a futile effort that tries to prevent information from being copied. It should go without saying that non-copyable information is an oxymoron. But alas, in the age of NFTs and plenty of other nonsense, I'm afraid this needs to be spelled out explicitly. So let me spell it out for you. You cannot create information that can't be copied. Period. Or in the words of Bruce Schneier, trying to make digital files uncopyable is like trying to make water not wet. The nature of information is such that if it can be read, it can also be copied with perfect fidelity. No amount of trickery or artificial restrictions will change this fact. This is why digital artifacts such as movies and music will always be available for free. It is trivial for someone who has access to said artifacts to copy said artifact, at near zero marginal cost, mind you, and make it accessible to others. Thus, given enough time and popularity, every movie, every song, and every document will be available to the general public for free. The nature of information does not allow for another outcome. Hence the saying, information wants to be free. Although trying to create something that can't exist, information that can't be copied, is paradoxical in itself, this isn't what I mean by the DRM paradox. What I mean is something more hilarious. It is again psychological, not technical in nature. The paradox is this: content will only stay behind a paywall if it is shitty. If it's good, someone will set it free. We all know this. If an article is actually worth reading, someone who is behind the paywall will screenshot it and post it to social media. If the movie is worth watching, it will be available on various websites that have pirate ships as their logos. If the song is worth listening to, it will be available on streaming sites for free. It is only the terrible articles, the most obscure movies, and the songs that make your ears bleed that stay locked behind paywalls. Hence, the paradox. Content will only stay locked behind paywalls if it sucks. If it's good, it will be set free. Personally, I believe that the MTX problem is a bigger deal than the DRM paradox. The traditional solution to the MTX problem is the subscription model, a la Netflix, Spotify, Amazon, and so on. The DRM paradox still remains, but it turns out that this is not an issue if you make the legitimate access to information convenient enough. The opportunity cost of downloading, storing, maintaining, and curating a private collection of songs is simply too high for most people. The more convenient solution is to pay for the damn Spotify subscription. That being said, we can already see one of the problems inherent in the subscription model. The following comic describes it well. The proliferation of streaming platforms forces you to get a Netflix subscription, an Amazon Prime subscription, a Hulu subscription, a Disney Plus subscription, a YouTube Premium subscription, and so on. And that was just streaming video. The same subscription zoo exists for music, books, games, newsletters, blog posts, etc. So, what is the solution? Accept the nature of information. The solution begins with acceptance. Selling digital content in the traditional, transactional way doesn't work, or at least doesn't work very well. A transaction involving a digital photograph of an apple is very different than a transaction involving a physical apple. George Bernard Shaw said it best, quote, "If you have an apple and I have an apple, and we exchange these apples, then you and I will still each have one apple. But if you have an idea and I have an idea, and we exchange these ideas, then each of us will have two ideas." Because digital information behaves like an idea, there is no reason to make it artificially scarce. This is not only true philosophically, but technically too. Computers are copying machines. Always have been, always will be. The only way to move information from one machine to another is to copy it. This alone should make the futility of treating information as physical objects blatantly obvious. When it comes to monetizing information on the open web, we have to align our ways of thinking with the nature of information. As outlined above, information is non-scarce, easily copied, easily modified, and wants to be free. I believe that the right monetization model has to respect these values and needs to have similar properties. It has to be open, transparent, extensible, and last but not least, completely voluntary. This model has a name: value for value. Revivifying busking. The idea is simple but sounds radical. You provide your content for free for everyone without access restrictions. If people enjoy it, if people get value out of it, you make it easy for people to give value back. It might sound outrageous in this day and age, but this model has worked for thousands of years. It is the model of street performers, the model of buskers, the model of voluntary giving. However, in cyberspace, we don't run into the physical limitations of traditional busking. Digital content scales in ways that performances in meat space never will. The value for value model flips the traditional payment model on its head. Traditionally, enjoyment follows payment. In the value for value approach, payment follows enjoyment, voluntarily. You are free to listen to the street musician and walk on, but, and this is something that the audience intuitively knows, if you want the music to continue, you should throw a couple of coins into the hat. One beautiful thing about this model is that it realigns incentives. You are not trying to maximize clicks or view time or any other of the countless metrics. You will want to provide value for your audience, and that's it. And if your audience got value out of it, a certain percentage will give back. All you have to do is ask. A valuable alternative. We are at the very beginning of this monumental shift. My hope is that the value for value model will continue to emerge as a viable alternative. An alternative to advertisements, censorship, deplatforming, and demonetization. The value for value model removes the, quote, they from the equation. They filter, they censor, they demonetize, they deplatform. It doesn't even matter who they are. If a they exists, they will find a way to fuck it up. Value for value removes they and puts you in charge. You are the ruler in the kingdom of one, solely responsible for your thoughts and your speech. If we want to have liberation and salvation in cyberspace, we need to put the individual in charge once more. As always, freedom and independence require responsibility. In the best of all worlds, creators are incentivized to do nothing but create, catering only to themselves and those who are interested in their creations. No intermediaries, directly, person to person, value for value. What lies ahead? Granted, as of today, it isn't exactly easy to self-host your infrastructure. It is intimidating to run your own node in order to receive payments in a self-sovereign manner. But not only will it get easier, increasingly, it will be necessary. In addition to making it all easier, we need to be cognizant of the MTX problem outlined above. Every step that manages to reduce the mental transaction costs in the value-for-value ecosystem is a step in the right direction. The value capability of Podcasting 2.0 is such a step. It enables and automates payments by the minute, without any additional interaction required by the user. Once you are set up, your wallet will make payments automatically. I believe that further iterations of this idea can be integrated into all media types, whether it be audio, video, images, the written word, and so on. I believe that we are close to the protocol version of Patreon. All the benefits of reducing the mental transaction costs to zero, without the friction and the censorship inherent in a platform-based solution. Whether it will come in the form of Bolt 12 recurring payments or something else entirely is yet to be seen. I am confident, however, that it will come in time. Conclusion. Not only is our fiat money broken, but the monetization model of the internet is broken too. The advertisement-based platforms of this day and age optimize for engagement via division and polarization, using dark patterns and addiction by design. It won't be easy to break out of the compulsion loops that are set up for us, but thanks to the self-sovereign tech stack that is currently emerging, there is a viable alternative, the value-for-value model. The, quote, busking monetization model has worked for many centuries in the past, and thanks to Bitcoin and the Lightning Network, I am confident that it will work for centuries into the future. We are almost there. We just need to figure out how to position the hat correctly on the ground, and where the best places in town are to perform, so to speak. Value for value does away with the DRM paradox in its entirety, and with the right amount of automation and sensible defaults, we'll solve the MTX problem too. If we get this right, we might be able to free ourselves from the evolutionary survival of the richest environment of platforms, allowing ourselves to step into the quasi-immortal realm of protocols. There is much to be explored, many tools to be built, and plenty of preconceived notions to be shattered. There is a seismic shift happening right in front of our eyes, and I'm looking forward to riding the waves with all of you. Onwards. All right, and that closes out The Freedom of Value by Dergigi, and let's hit our sponsor real quick for this show. And we will jump back in, and I want to do Guy's take on this because there's a lot of fascinating things to, a lot of fascinating strings to pull on with this one, and it's definitely something that I've been watching very closely more recently because it looks like the value for value model is having a lot of growth, and so I really want to talk about that. So let's take a quick break for our sponsor, and we will jump back in. And that sponsor is going to be Swan Bitcoin. So what do you know about Swan Private? Now, everybody knows Swan Bitcoin. You can auto-stack. It's low cost. They got great, simple customer service. Everything just works. It automatically sends it to your keys, and they pay the on-chain fees, unlike some other exchanges. Coinbase sucks. But do you know about Swan Private, the concierge service? They know there are wealthier players, companies, businesses, retirement people who are trying to move significant sums of money out of harm's way, like the retirement accounts that are getting clobbered in the stock market right now. That is what Swan Private was built for. You can hold this within your IRA, your Roth, your 401k. You get direct access to their team. And I promise you there is no better team to have direct access to regarding your Bitcoin. If you're trying to learn Bitcoin, and you know, understand how to protect your wealth, this is the team to use. You have a trust that you're trying to manage, a business account, or any other entity account, really. Swan has your back. They will walk you through a best custody setup for your situation. They will teach you how to hold your keys, and they will be there to help whenever you need them. Come on, from zero to Bitcoin holder does not get easier than this. And you get access to their private groups. They got invitation-only sessions. You can just ask questions. It's open discussion. Cover any topics in the news, any concerns you've got, anything on your mind. So check out Swan Private. I know you're thinking, oh, I'll just do it later. Don't. These are crazy times. And the best thing you can do is protect your wealth as fast as possible. Learn about Bitcoin. Hold your keys. Swan Bitcoin is the way to do that. SwanBitcoin.com/guy and check out Swan Private. All right. So let's talk about Gigi's piece, The Freedom of Value. He starts this piece off just talking about, you know, the internet is broken. And it's funny because it is and it isn't. It is. I'm not really disagreeing with Gigi here. It's one of those things where you unlock, the internet is such a unique beast. it, it has unlocked an entirely new environment that has an entire set of incentives in and of itself. And because we broke into this new space so fast and we started utilizing it for what it was good for how we could get information so quickly that we failed to understand the structure and how it was changing things, how it was changing our behaviors and how our incentives within this space was causing us to miss, I guess you could say, to overlook a significant vulnerability. Essentially, maybe it's not a vulnerability, it's just kind of like a psychological poison that is sitting at the heart of the incentive structure. And there's a quote that kind of got me, the first quote that I saved here, it says, "We seldom stop and think about the strange world of bits and bytes, how wonderful it all is, but also how alien, how it already has transformed our lives and how it will continue to transform our future. Where do the zeros and ones come from? What makes it all work? And most importantly, who is paying for it?" And I love the word alien. It says, you know, how wonderful it all is, but also how alien. The way the internet works is being treated the same way the physical world works. We think of it analogously to the physical world. We call it cyberspace. Our whole totem for reality is that this is some other extension of the physical world. All of our patterns and all of our senses of thinking and how we think about the value and the ownership and stuff in this space, all of it we reference as compared to the physical world. But it is truly alien. It's not the physical world. So he says that the quote, and I love that quote, is, you know, if we exchange, if you have an apple and I have an apple and we exchange apples, we both still have one apple. If I have an idea and you have an idea and we exchange ideas, we both have two ideas. That is the nature of the internet. And you cannot put the same restrictions on that space, on something with that reality, as the restrictions that you put on the apples. The ideas are not the same. They are completely different. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the other major thing about that quote is, who is paying for it? How is it being paid? We've paid for all of this with our data, with advertisements, with our attention. And the incentives that come with that are just to keep you stuck. Are just to keep you stuck. And holy shit, does Twitter do that to me. It is amazing. And it's so funny too, when I step outside of myself. I just got, was reading a thread about addiction, which is so true. God, there is nothing more addicting than the dopamine rush of Twitter and the constant, like, look at the notifications. Who responded to my shit? That's a stupid comment. I'm gonna show that person what is the truth. They don't know what they're talking about. And you know, the whole thing is such a, like, it's this constant ache for, like, just this tiny little thing, this video to like, or this thing to laugh at. And I catch myself, it's such an unconscious thing. Like, when I'm working on stuff, I'll just get stuck. Like, I'll just be recording, like, here in the middle of something, and I'll pause and I'll be like, what was that thing that I needed to do? And, you know, I don't want to sound like an idiot and just say, oh, that crap, and I don't remember what the name of it is. So I'll go try to look it up and read a little bit about it as I get through a guide stick. And then I'll go look up something, and somehow I'll just be on Twitter. I don't even know. Like, I'm looking up that person's Twitter account, maybe, or sometimes there's just no reason for me to have ever been there. It was just like I opened up the browser and managed to navigate my way to Twitter. And it's funny because I have to, like, I have a very, very active, like, attack. Like, when I realize I am on Twitter and I've posted two tweets and responded to five things, I'm like, crap, what am I doing? How did I get here again? It's like I blacked out and then showed up at Twitter again. And then I have to actively tell myself to leave these notifications, do not answer these messages, turn it off and go back and get back to recording. I don't know what they did with the algorithm, but it works. It works on me. And I wouldn't blame it entirely on the funding mechanism, like, because those incentives are there and they will worse. Everything will be worse because of how that structure is set up, because of the keep you there so that you can click on ads or just watch ads, right? You just need people in front of it looking at it. Because that is the funding model, that exacerbates any sort of underlying cultural problem that is already there, even though we already have an insanely high time preference, instant gratification culture. I think the pushback against it would not work as well if we had grown up in a very low time preference culture. Like, it is explicitly Bitcoin and doing things for Bitcoin that have gotten me in this state where I feel like I need to actively fight against that and stay off of Twitter. And I do a mixed bag of job. Like, I don't spend 6 hours a day on Twitter, thank God. I have in the past, but I'm much better at managing. I have a bunch of little tricks, but they're all just to keep me away from it. One of the ones I've been using recently, actually, I use the focus thing on Apple on iOS for the Twitter app. And then I use limit extension for Brave or Chrome, whatever you're using, any Chrome based web browser. And you can just set it to tell you when you've been at a certain time on this website, and then it will limit. You can just set it to like an hour, 2 hours every day. And that's just it. Anyway, I'm kind of off topic, but I have a Twitter problem and I wanted to share it. Hi, my name is Guy and I'm addicted to Twitter. They make sure of it. They make sure of it. Everything about their design is to keep you there. And that's not just Twitter. That's all of them. That is everything. And I love the term, and he's got a link actually in the article. Where is it? Legos. I'm going to search. Okay, so it's why this is also why most YouTube channels devolve into 7 to 15 minute snippets with thumbnails that portray the face of someone who just stepped on a piece of Legos. I did not explore this link yet. It's just a picture from his Twitter account, but it's pretty great. But that is so true. It's so true. The thumbnails of all of these things are just like people like freaking out, and then it's like a whole bunch of big text, and it's all obnoxious. It feels kind of cringe to me. But that's what keeps people there. That's what keeps the attention. That's what keeps you watching, and that's what keeps you watching just long enough for you to forget, just like I forget why the hell I ended up on Twitter. And like, I'll go to Twitter or whatever for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and waste time and respond to people, and then I'll be like, I gotta get off of Twitter, and I'll go back to the thing I was doing. I realized I was just trying to find, like, the Twitter link to Gigi's profile so that I could put in the show notes. And I will have realized that I had done all of this and not even gotten the one thing I needed to go get. But because they monetize our attention, that is how they end up being designed. And we become programmed. Their entire system is around conditioning us to respond a certain way and do a certain thing when we go there. And that's everybody's game now. That is the game on the internet, is how do you get people's attention? And we're in a space where what we focus our attention on is everything. It's everything. You know, how you think about the world and how you relate to the information you consume, that is it. That's who you are, and that's how you relate to the world. That's your Overton window. That's all of it. We have a very, very limited amount of time that we can access any subset of the information available to us. And in the information age, in a hundred years, we have gone from having no information to access and being desperate, you know, to reach through friends to try to get another book about a topic or something, to having such an overabundance of information that our problem is how to filter it, because we can learn anything that we ever wanted to know about anything right now. We can learn the conspiracy theory side of it. We can learn the nuanced side of it. We can learn the mainstream, this is definitely the way it is and don't ever question it side of it. We can learn the government approved side of it. Like all of it. It's just all available. But because of that, we could spend our entire lives learning more and more about something that's completely made up, about something that's completely wrong, that's just foundationally a misunderstanding. And then, you know, years and years of piecing evidence on top of it, and it's just wrong. And when you have that relationship, that new relationship to information, to essentially infinite optionality, how easy does it become to create that polarization, to create that in-group and isolate ideas, to reinforce people within their group and polarize people outside of it, so that the mainstream only sees the mainstream and the conspiracy theorists only see the conspiracy theorists, et cetera, et cetera. One of the best things in this whole article, I thought, that his short answer, Gigi's short answer on this, is as if I was forced to give a short answer as to why this has all happened, why we're here, what is the cause, the source of our current situation in the internet era, is this. We moved from protocols to platforms, and platforms are only as good as their incentives. I love that. We moved from protocols to platforms. The environment that we communicate in is now totally controlled because it's a totally fake environment. It's artificial. This is so much like what happened to our money that necessitated Bitcoin's existence. And I think this is also why, you know, even a bunch of shitcoiners get so, like, Bitcoin, the cypherpunks, like, so many people have been so serious about a social media protocol, about communication protocols to replace these platforms. And I think that's why everybody got all excited and immediately dumped into the hopium of, you know, a shitcoin that was going to run a social media platform and a Twitter feed on, you know, BSV or whatever it was. It's a problem that we know needs to be solved. We realize, even if it's not explicit, like we couldn't write a paper on it, but we see that the problem of the platforms and social media and the censorship is the same issue that happened with our money, with the fact that the money became a permissioned environment itself. Like, you can't own dollars, digital dollars, outside of a bank, outside of someone's explicit authority. The very nature of a digital dollar is an authoritative thing. It is something that someone with the quote-unquote power to give you permission to have a dollar, giving you permission to have a dollar. It's just a ledger on somebody's account. And there's just a closed group of very important banking people of finance, this permissioned group that's allowed to grant you that access. Everybody else, in every other context, the digital dollar doesn't exist. And as soon as you lose their permission, as soon as you lose their quote unquote authority to own the dollars, it just might as well not exist. It's gone. It is purely their permission. It is purely their authority that the dollar exists in the first place. Look at all the problems that come with that. I mean, it's just like he says in this, is the point of all that he went through with the free speech platforms and the censorship and the incentives, all of this stuff. He says the point is the following. Free speech platforms cannot exist. Only free speech protocols can exist. If someone can control what is being said, someone will control what is being said. If you can monitor, filter, and censor content, you will monitor, filter, and censor content. I'll tell you the best example of this right now that I say, if any free speech platform, if anybody anywhere says that they will be quote unquote in charge of something or they will run something ideologically, and that will mean that, you know, it will never be compromised or it will never censor. Look at Wasabi. Look at Wasabi. I have never seen a group of people so dedicated to privacy. Like, I trust all of those guys. Like, the team over there is amazing. They have built an incredible technology and an incredible wallet. But as a coordinator, they are attackable. As a coordinator, they are public. And what did they have to do? Wasabi Wallet has just announced that they have to actively censor quote-unquote bad UTXOs. And they're going to have to work with Chainalysis to know which UTXOs they have to freaking keep out of their mixes. Now, obviously, somebody else could mix. Like, the code is still there. The wallet is still there. Everything still works. It's great. But as a service, they are now censoring the UTXOs that go into the mix because they will be held legally liable for it. If that is not a perfect example of the situation, if it is built in such a way where someone can censor, you have the best example of the most ideologically pure. These poor bastards have poured years into this project to build a privacy tool that they are now being forced to censor themselves. And what, you think Gab isn't going to do that at some point? All the just replace the old platform with the new free speech platform is just going through the headache of starting the network effect over for a platform that's going to do the same thing. That at some point there's no getting around it. The incentive structure is the same. The problem is the same. The fighting for everyone's attention is the same. All they need to do is create clickbait. They need to, you know, make it an outrage platform, and they need to keep your attention as long as possible. It's all the same. It's going to be there sooner or later, one way or another. Now, after you realize that, you begin to see what the problems are, or you at least can address the problems honestly. And I like I'm not sure if this is his framing. I don't think I've ever heard this. I will call the MTX problem. Okay. So yeah, maybe these are GG's terms, but the MTX problem, the mental transaction problem, and the digital rights management, the DRM paradox. And we've talked about the mental transaction problem on the show a lot. Actually, we've read Minimizing Consumer Worry, and I think I read the Micropayments and Mental Transaction Costs by Nick Szabo, if I'm not mistaken. It's why I've always been curious, like because when you make it as frictionless as possible, which is obviously the goal, you don't want the mental transaction. Like, this is a very axiomatic sort of idea. Like, if you're trying to argue with yourself over whether or not this is worth a 1 cent payment, the very stress of having to make that decision is worth more than 1 cent to the average person. And that is where you get into this weird space of micropayments, where Lightning is such a great tool for micropayments. And even Bitcoin early on, everybody thought this was going to be micropayments because, you know, we were sending, you know, Satoshi Dice and all these like thousands and thousands of payments and things. But that's like kind of the beauty of an open protocol on the internet is like, oh, we can do micropayments. And you can so easily come up with these beautiful ideas of these things that you could do, streaming payments and, you know, paywalls for everything. They're all just a penny. And, oh, it would be no big deal whatsoever if everybody just got normal doing it. But you don't think about the fact that these are mental transaction costs, that there is a cost that has nothing to do with the payment itself of having to decide whether or not you really want to look at this shit or not. And no matter what you do on the internet, someone else will give it away for free and put an ad in front of you. That's what this show is, right? Like, I did it for like a year or whatever without ads, but I have ads now. They fund the show. And that's a whole lot easier. I would like to have a paywall option available for like, you know, 100 sats or 50 cent or whatever. But I don't know if that's actually going to work with the user. I don't know if the user is actually going to go for that. But I'm totally okay with building it and testing it and trying out this value for value thing. Like I think all of these models, there's something to them. And I think Gigi is right. There is something here. Something is going to change because there is a model out there that works. And it may very well be this. it may be this value for value model. Because as soon as you take out the, you know, the huge fees of the middleman, of the Patreons out there, of the Amazons and, you know, all these, I mean, good God, like people, most people don't even know that, like, when you do like an audiobook on ACX or Audible, ACX is like the company or whatnot. But when you do an audiobook, you know, you don't get the author and the narrator. I mean, depending on the agreement, there's like a couple different configurations. But let's say you do a revenue split, which I've done with a handful of the authors or whatnot, where, you know, you don't know how many they're going to be sold. It's just like, all right, well, screw it. We just won't do any pay and we'll just split whatever we get. Well, we only get 40%. We split 40%. So the author gets 20%. I would get 20% for the audiobook. And Amazon takes 60. And that's like a good deal. That's like normal. Now, what would value for value have to make up in downloads or listeners or people paying for it to be able to make a comparable amount when 60% of it is going to the platform? I don't know. I feel like when something sticks and something lands, and the streaming stats may very well be a big part of this. I'm really excited about some of the things I've learned in the last couple of months and the activity that has been happening on streaming sats. And actually Fountain, I'm not sure if you guys know, but the Fountain app, they've we're supposed to start like some sort of thing where like Bitcoin Audible listeners can get like 1,000 free sats. Holy crap. Hold on a second. Let me pause this real quick because he sent me something. I'll give you details. And I'm gonna edit it out. And then with the magic of editing, you're never gonna know I was gone. Abracadabra. Okay, so yeah. So every new user who would listen to my podcast on Fountain gets 1,000 sats. And then one of them will win 50,000 sats on the Fountain app. So Fountain is a podcast app. I don't even think I said that. Fountain is a podcast app that has the value for value thing built into it. So it's streaming sats and, you know, it's obviously got like a little Bitcoin wallet and stuff. So they would just give you 1,000 sats within the Bitcoin wallet for listening to Bitcoin Audible on the value for value. And so you could just try it out. Like they're just trying to get people because there's been a lot of activity and a lot of new traffic over there that I've been hearing about from a couple of different people. So I'm really excited to see it. I've actually downloaded and used Fountain app a little bit very recently. Before they actually reached out to me. So I've been very interested. This is something that I would love to, and I've been trying to put together an ad-free feed for exactly something like this, to separate this, to have one that, you know, you just donate sats to, or you pay a whatever you want per minute or whatnot, and you can get an ad-free version, or you can listen to the free version on your typical podcast app. Is an idea that I've wanted to tackle for a long time, and I may, fingers so crossed, I may actually have a way to have that happen now. We're about to see. I'm getting closer. I just saw something demoed for me that I'm very, very excited about. So I'm hoping that we are not far away from that solution. But anyway, yeah, check out Fountain app. I'm sure there is going to be a link or something. I haven't even messaged him back yet. I kind of feel bad about it. It's been sitting there, but I'm sure there will be a link, and I will use a redirect, so you can go to guyswan.com/fountain, and I will have it in the show notes the second I get it, probably be sometime tomorrow. So if you want your free sats, do that, and check out the Fountain app. But yeah, so that was a big distraction from the MTX problem, so the mental transaction cost problem. The other problem was the DRM paradox, and this had me laughing. I had to read this twice because I broke down laughing in the middle of it. Quote, "The paradox is this. Content will only stay behind a paywall if it is shitty. If it's good, someone will set it free." That is amazing because that is 100% true. I never have to figure out what an article is about or what the highlights of an article are behind a paywall if it's good. It is on Twitter. And I just go scrolling through the thread. Somebody's got it. If there's something worth it, or if there's something that I should be mad about, you know, if they highlight something exceptionally clown world-esque or just unbelievably stupid, oh, well, I get that too on Twitter. Same with movie content, songs, all of it. Clearly, the good stuff breaks through all of the permissioned barriers. The shitty stuff stays right there behind it. If the information can be read, it can be copied. You know, actually, you know, and I think a lot of people don't think about this, but everything that you do with information on a computer is actually copying it. Like, yes, it can be read, and that means it can be copied, but the act of reading it is actually copying it. So, like, you know, generally you're, you know, and Gigi even says it in this thing, to move it is just to copy it. The only way to move information in, you know, cyberspace or on a computer is to copy it to a new location and just delete it in the old location. But it doesn't actually move from the old location. You just have to delete the original. But the act of watching a movie is copying it. Like, if you've got a movie on your hard drive, what you're doing is you're copying the movie as you're watching it into RAM so that your RAM can then send it to your processor and your graphics card can then, you know, process it and spit out all the proper colors and the amount of light on each of the millions of individual pixels across your screen. It's just copies all the way down. And same with viewing any sort of video or anything online. If you're watching it on your computer, it is on your computer. Like, the video file is there. Like, the stream, like, however you want to do it, they can do everything they can to make it annoying. They can break it up into 30,000 little packets that make it really hard to rip, and you don't know what, you know, order they're in. They've got their own little special code, and they've got the little DRM protection on the software that they make you watch. But it doesn't matter. Like, it all still is just, it just makes it, like, slightly more of a headache. If you're displaying video and audio on your computer, running it through your video and audio drivers, you can redirect that wherever you want. You can snag anything that is playing on your computer. It is not like a super technical know-how to do that. The most protected information out there, stuff that people spend millions and millions of dollars on trying to protect, is very easy to copy. What if we could just accept that? What if we could realize that that is the state of information on the internet? But we could change the money in such a way, we could fix the problems with the platforms of money that make it essentially necessitate that we go the opposite direction. He talked about the two different directions where you pay first and then you expect to be entertained, whereas, you know, you go back 200 years, you were entertained and then you paid. This was a common thing. And he used the term busking, which I don't know, maybe I'm just an idiot, but I'd never actually heard the term busking before. But if you are like me and you're one of the few morons who didn't know what that word meant, but it literally is just the activity of, like, playing music in the street. So playing in a public space for voluntary donations, that is busking. But you think about it, the nature of the money in the digital space, it has to be a certain way or that's not even possible. It's certainly not possible without a platform to do it for you. And what percent is that platform going to take? 60%? I mean, what are you paying for? There's censorship? Network effects are a bitch. Oh, and on the nature of busking, actually, in this article, which I encourage you to go do, actually, in this article, he has a, there's a line that says, you're free to listen to the street musician and walk on, but, and this is something that the audience intuitively knows, if you want the music to continue, you should throw a couple of coins into the hat. And then he oh so serendipitously has a button with a little hat and a lightning symbol on it says, give value back right there. And I donated 2,100 sats. And I might donate again, but I encourage you guys to go donate. If you enjoyed this article, Gigi was busking for you guys. Go throw some value back. Let's test this out. Because I think, you know, it's not that I'm convinced streaming sats is going to be the thing. It's not that I'm convinced subscriptions won't still be like a huge part of the model, or that there won't still be free value with advertisements. But here is what I know for certain, and I think Gigi lays out the argument very well in this, is that the money has changed, and thus the incentives are going to be able to change with it. The model for sending and receiving value, for paying for people, is absent of a is external to a platform. And because of that, for the first time, we have the option of making protocols. It is only because of the protocol of money that we now have the ability to make protocols for all of these other things suddenly. We can fund them. We can monetize them in a way that is that gets around the platform problem. And simply put, something is going to work. So throw a few sats in Gigi's hat, check out Fountain app, check out Sphinx, test these things out, try value for value, get a Lightning wallet if you haven't yet. There's some real magic there, and I think we're on the verge of something really big. So with that, I just want to thank you guys for listening to the show, for sticking with me, for everybody who streams sats, for the Audionauts who have been supporting this show for God knows how long. Man, you guys have stuck with me for ages. And my sponsors, Bitbox, Bitcoin 2022, and Swan Bitcoin, for helping keep this show alive as well. But I fully believe we are headed into a future of protocols replacing platforms. And we're just at the beginning. And Bitcoin and Lightning is what makes this possible. So this is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.